This week, Matt Alderman joins us. For those that don't know, I actually used to work for Matt at Tenable, where formerly he was the VP of Strategy. And Matt has a history in computer security and will be on to talk startups with us. He's very active in the startup world. In startup articles and discussion, think twice about listening to business gurus. A tech advisor analyzed his 5,000 monthly emails and explained how startups can stand out. Don't build a startup, build a business. Can Google's 20% time really work for your startup? And other articles as well. Honeywell is in the news, as well as some articles about cybersecurity startups, risk, recon, counterattack. I think we already talked about some of the other ones like CrowdStrike we talked about last week. There are some other investments that I think we already covered. So we'll talk about the ones that are in there today and more on this episode of Startup Security Weekly. This is Security Weekly, for security professionals by security professionals. Broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island, it's the show about security startups, how to secure your startup, and advice for security startups. It's Startup Security Weekly. I need it from the top. Brought to you by, do you have a website, an external presence, employees, an office? Any of these things can be compromised and attacked. How are you defending these assets? Have you penetration tested these public assets? Start 2017 by taking a proactive approach to securing your vulnerable areas. Black Hills Information Security has been helping companies find their weaknesses since 2008. Email consulting at blackhillsinfosec.com and see how they can help you sleep better at night. Welcome to Startup Security Weekly. I'm your host, Paul Asadorian. It is, in fact, June 2nd, and this is episode 42, The Answer to Life, the Universe, and Everything. Hopefully, our special guest has all of those answers as well. The beach bum himself, and I'm still going to call you that until you're not the beach bum, Mr. Michael Santarcangelo is here with us. Michael, welcome to the show.
It's always good to be with you. Yes. You know, this time of year, you're warming up too, but I'm still going to take the beach as long as I got it. So it works out.
And I haven't like talked to you since like last week. It's terrible. John Strand and I were talking about this. Like everyone thinks that the host and I like talk every night and like, oh, how was your day today, Michael? Like not like a lot of times we're so busy. We don't get a chance to talk until we're on the show live. So
that this is where we catch up. This is our hangout.
Right. Yeah, this is our hangout time. Oh, boy. Well, I'm excited to introduce our guest today, Mr. Matt Alderman, who, as I mentioned in the beginning, Matt and I worked together at Tenable. We had a lot of fun at Tenable, and I have very fond memories of like sitting in Matt's office going, so what do you think about me working for you and your group, huh? And there the friendship was formed. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Yeah, it was, I remember that conversation pretty well. And then people were like, well, wait a minute, we just put him into product marketing. Why are we going to move him over to the strategy team? But yeah, we did have a lot of fun together.
And Matt, it was really there that I learned a lot more about the security space, emerging trends. As the VP of strategy for Tenable, we were talking about containers before the show, right? Like over a year ago, you and I were talking about, well, how does that impact vulnerability management? How does SIEM in the cloud impact our market space? And all these things, the next generation web app. I mean, we've had these conversations. The companies that we talk about today on Enterprise Security Weekly and Startup Security Weekly are stuff that like Matt and I were talking about over a year ago, because it was Matt's job to look at the strategy for the company.
And you never did give me full credit for both of these new shows, because the work we did at Tenable created Enterprise and Startup Security Weekly.
Well, and you know what? I was like, well, now I'm not at Tenable. I'm like, I really am interested in these topics. What are we going to, I'm like, well, let's just make a show out of them. So I still get to research and talk about them. And that's essentially what we did. And it turns out people really like hearing about it. So here we are today. Now, Matt, what you are like involved in the startup world, explain kind of your involvement in how you follow and track and help companies today.
Yeah. So when I left Tenable about a month ago or so, I decided to do a little advisory work on the side. So I've been connecting with different VC firms, some of their startups, in trying to help them get to the next step. Now, Ron Gula and I have stayed very close. You know, Ron's been doing some incubator work and some acceleration stuff. And so I've talked to a number of his companies. We're trying to figure out, you know, how to get the company kind of to the next level. Some of these guys are pre-series A, some are A or B round, but are really starting to look for kind of the next, you know, kind of steps to accelerate the business. So I've been doing a little bit of on the side while I've kind of figured out where's my next permanent home.
Right.
So there's a number of them that I've been kind of working with over the past 6-8 weeks or so. But even before that, I was sitting on advisory boards for One World Labs. You know, I've tried to stay pretty connected with the VCs. And in at Tenable, we tracked somewhere over 280 different companies in all the adjacencies to VM, because it was something that we wanted to continue to find potentially pre-revenue or early revenue companies that would fit into the portfolio. So you know, I've been doing this for the last 3+ years, even when we were at Tenable, just trying to figure out who's out there and who might be a good fit.
So a lot of startups, I feel like, Matt, they start out with hopefully what is a really good idea. And then, you know, they may get like a seed round or some angel funding, and they're solving what I believe to be like a really niche problem. And I think where your advice could come in is, you know, do they have to grow the product? And if they do grow the product and expand functionality, where do they go? So like, what are some of your conversations around, okay, well, we're solving this problem. Like, what if we were to branch out and do this other thing? What does that look like? And what kind of advice do you give companies looking for that next step?
Yeah, I think the biggest challenge most of the startups have right now is they have a great technology or product. They have an idea. Part of the problem is they haven't extracted out what's that longer term vision, right? What do they want to be when they grow up, is kind of a simple way to say it, right? Is, do you want to go change the way SIMs are redone? Do you want to change endpoint detection? Or you know, there's all kinds of examples. Every company has a unique vision and point of view of the product that they're building, right? And part of the big challenge for them is to get that messaging right. They have an interesting idea, maybe an MVP, but they haven't articulated it well to the market. So they're having problems getting traction in the market, or they're having problems growing the revenue that they need to go get the Series A or the Series B. So part of my work is to try to help extract out some of that messaging using some of my old marketing structures that I used in the past to try to extract that out and create a consistent message for the company. That helps them with their website, their offerings, maybe some naming, try to get some traction in the market. I'm a big believer that you have to define your own category. You can't just follow what the analysts do, because the analysts are always behind everybody else.
But that's so really hard, though. And I personally know of a lot of innovative companies that they're like creating their own niche. And I think that, for example, a lot of companies today feel like, well, I need some kind of endpoint solution, and I need a SIM, and I need some kind of network monitoring. But there's lots of ways to solve those same problems that endpoint is solving, for example. And those companies really, I think, struggle and need some help in that area.
Yeah. And so part of, you know, what happens in some respects is somebody defines a new market for endpoint detection response, and then 80 plus companies flock to it, right? And they all get funding. Well, they're all fighting after the same message. I can detect and respond. If you can't elevate your message above the rest of the noise, you're stuck. You're truly stuck. And you're starting to see that with the EDRs, you know, CrowdStrike taken around, you know, a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, it took $100 million.
So you've got Tanium, CrowdStrike, Carbon Black, Cylance consuming the EDR space. If you're an EDR, how do you get out of that? So I'm actually advising one right now who wants to get funded in EDR. And I look at them and I go, there's no way. It's too noisy of a space. So the question is, can your technology be applied to another problem that no one else is solving? Because if it can, I might be able to get you funded over there. But you can't just follow the rat race here and going, hey, I'm the 87th, 88th EDR company to get funded in the last 4 years. It doesn't work, right? So the founders and the executives of the company really need to start to figure out what is that next thing. Because if they don't, they're going to get stuck in the noise of everything else. And EDR is a perfect example where it's just hard to get above the four of them, because they just consume all the news.
Mm, absolutely.
Yeah, they're all the unicorns too. Matt, when you're working with people, how often do you find that it's they don't know the problem they're trying to solve and therefore they're struggling to articulate it versus, no, no, they have it, but they're struggling to articulate it? Like, which is do you uncover more often?
I uncover most really good entrepreneurs know the base problem they're trying to solve and have kind of a starting vision. And they build technology around it, and they love the technology, and the technology is pretty cool when you look at it. But people don't understand it on the other side, the buyer. Who's the buyer? What value does it solve? Or what problems does it solve? What value does it provide? That's really hard for technology companies, I think, to get across. I rarely run across a company that hasn't figured out the problem they're solving or the vision. It's typically the articulation of those so that they can start to get some traction in the market. That's the bigger one I'm seeing right now.
So, Matt, who are some startups that you're working with that like get you really excited? I mean, you said at Tenable you were tracking over 200. Are there particular ones that you want to highlight for our listeners? I think a large portion of our listeners are folks that want to know who the new innovative companies are that are doing really well, that have technology that works so they can evaluate it.
Yeah, so I put together a little list this morning of different segments that I'm tracking that I like. And some of the companies, now I'm not advising all these companies. Some of these people I've seen out there that I think are doing innovative things. A couple of these folks I've been talking to and trying to help along the way. Let's start with WannaCry for a second, right? Because that's all the news lately. Everybody's like, oh my gosh, I can detect WannaCry. And my answer is, stop crying, just patch. So there's an interesting patch management company up in Boulder called AutoMox that allows you to automate the patching side. Their traffic has increased by like double since WannaCry. Mm-hmm. I kind of like what they're doing. They're more small, medium enterprise, people that don't have resources and the big patch management processes in the enterprise. A very simple way to just check for updates and apply patches, right? I mean, everybody had a 2-month window to patch for WannaCry, and obviously a lot of people failed doing that for whatever reason. So I like them. You've got people in the automation side. I do like the kind of the security orchestration automation space. Respond Software is building a product right now. Some of their folks are here in Colorado, and they're more on the response and the automation of the playbook side, which I think is an interesting space when you detect. Let's see. In the container space, I love the container and application security space. For a while. We were talking about containers earlier. So Banyan Ops, which is out of California, Taryn, the CEO, and I have been talking for a little bit. We did some analysis of their software at Tenable, but he reached out to me after I left and said, hey, can you help me a little bit? And he's got an interesting product that helps discover the microservice communications, which helps to discover these new complex apps. And then he's looking at ways to put security and protection around them. I like what they're doing. You know, Melinda went over to StackRox. They're getting ready to release a product here pretty soon in the container space, which obviously I love. Aporeto just got funded a couple weeks ago. I knew them pretty early on before the funding round. Again, these are three companies in the container space that are going to start to make some noise here really, really soon. I like all of them. Some of them do some similar stuff, but the space is hot, right? And that's kind of the next
like how large is that? Security. How large is that market in your opinion? If, again, the other audience that listens to the show, I believe, is people who want to create a startup in security. So how big of an opportunity do we have, with this DevOps and container, I think, trend that is, it's not going away, right?
No, it's not going away. And I can't put a number to it. I haven't tried to do that analysis yet. No one's asked me to do that yet. But think about this, right? We're moving away from data centers into cloud infrastructure. We're going to build these new applications with DevOps processes. They're all going to leverage containerization as part of these new applications, and the market's only going to get bigger. Now, there's a lot of legacy sitting around, and eventually that legacy environment's going to migrate over to the new container world, which is only going to make that market continue to expand. So it's not huge today, but it's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger as we move legacy apps out of the data center into these new container-based apps up in the cloud. And so I think it's a really interesting market that's going to have a lot of growth potential to it over the next 3, 5, 7 years, because that's what companies are, they're going to keep moving there.
Right. Even locally, there's a lot of, it makes a lot of sense to put containers in, even if you're going to run it locally in your own cloud or in your own infrastructure. There's stuff that still needs to run locally. And of course, it's very applicable to the cloud. So
right.
I think for that reason, like, it's going to be a pretty decent sized market.
Yeah. One of the other companies that I've been doing some work with is an EDR company, Digital Immunity, up in Boston. And they're one that's been trying to get funded in the EDR space. And they have a really good EDR product. I actually like it because it's kernel based. But because it's kernel based, it can also address the container side of the equation, right? And so, you know, is there an opportunity to port the technology over and address containers where they can actually do a memory?
Oh, Matt froze there. Oh, he's still frozen. Oh, he's image. Back. You froze there for a moment, Matt. You're back now. Sorry.
Oh, I'm back. Sorry. Yeah, sorry. I was saying, you know, can they port their EDR technology over to address the container side of the equation? I think that's a very interesting possibility. And if it is, they have a really unique offering there for kernel-based memory, not only of the endpoint, but potentially of the container environment themselves. So it's just some interesting stuff that's out there that I've seen over the past few weeks.
That's awesome. Michael, did you have other questions for Matt? I want to hog the stage.
No, I've been enjoying the repartee and taking notes, actually. So I've kind of dug it. But let's actually go back to that idea of that crowded space, and then maybe going back and reevaluating the problem you're solving and figuring out either if it applies to something else or there's a different way to cast it. You know, some of what I've been picking up too is that sometimes, and Matt, I'm kind of curious your take on this, it's that we've gotten too stovepiped in trying to solve a problem. And it sounds like some of the technologies that you're looking at or the folks you've talked to, they can actually go and solve two or three problems at the same time. Does that make it easier for them, or does that make it harder? Because then people get really confused because of the way we've grooved out how security is supposed to be.
Yeah, well, this is the problem we were trying to tackle at Tenable a little bit, right? When we built the holistic security kind of messaging and looking at security is a holistic set of capabilities, not a bunch of point products, right? So the first part of the question is, yeah, we've all been focused on point solutions, defense in depth, point solutions. That's the way we've all tried to tackle this space in some respects. And for years, I've been telling people, you know, I think defense in depth is broken. It doesn't allow us to connect the different layers of technologies. Therefore, we've created gaps, and this is where the attackers hide, right? And so, you know, we were really trying to focus people on holistic security approach. So it's great that companies can solve more than one problem for their customers, right? I think there is a little bit of fatigue by customers to have multiple solutions, multiple point solutions, lots of vendors. So there is interest in doing that. Here's where things get interesting. If you don't have that kind of clear value proposition, clear message, and that point of view of how you're solving that problem uniquely, you'll never get customers to buy into the vision. That's the big challenge I think a lot of the technology companies have right now, is if they can truly articulate where they provide the most value as part of their point of view and a little broader problem that they're trying to solve, then I think these companies have a pretty good chance of doing that. So let me give you a couple examples of people that have kind of started to do that a little bit. Take ServiceNow. IT service management space, right? They own the category. It's theirs. They've completely reinvented ITSM. Now what you're going to see from them, and you're starting to see it a little bit, is this expansion more into the security and GRC side. Can they, taking their core asset database, start to bring security and compliance capabilities onto that platform to start to solve security and GRC in a unique way? If they can get that messaging right and they can build those capabilities, they could be pretty disruptive to the core, both security and GRC market spaces, because they have the core asset data, which is critical to understanding risk, right? So they're ones that I see trying to do this a little bit, right? The smaller guys, it gets a little harder though, right? Because they start as a point solution. They have to build enough brand equity before they can start to go broader. And so it's harder for somebody like that to do it. So you see a little bit of a mix depending on who they are and what space they're currently in.
So if you're a startup today, and to use ServiceNow as an example, do you integrate with ServiceNow, or do you take what they're doing in security and just do it better so that you keep them out of the space? Or I guess that depends on your strategy. Like, how do you approach each of those decisions?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously ServiceNow is the 800-pound gorilla from the IT asset side. So I think you have to integrate with them in some respects. The question is, based on where you want to go, do they become a competitor or not? And therefore, long term, are they friend or foe? And smaller companies can get a lot of traction by leveraging an integration with a ServiceNow or a Palo Alto or a, you know, a Splunk or whoever. They all have ownership in their categories in some respects, right? And so there is advantage to partner with some of those folks. But if you can't do it better or different, then it will be hard to compete if you think they're going to be a competitor. And that's when you have to just know when to kind of cut your losses.
Yeah, pivot.
Maybe go a different way. Yeah, yeah. Right.
Yeah, or it becomes an acquisition plan, right? Like that your exit is get good enough, fast enough that it's cheaper for them just to buy you than to try to crush you 6 months down the road.
Yeah, I mean, Cisco's a great example of this, right? Every single Cisco acquisition over the past couple of years has been a strategic partner like LandCope or some of these other ones, right? That they augmented Cisco, they grew the business together, and Cisco said, yeah, it's just time to buy them, right? So if your exit strategy is you want to get bought, partnering with a ServiceNow or a Splunk or a Cisco or any of those guys, Palo Alto, they have an opportunity for you to get consumed and bought into the portfolio as part of a broader play. It's not a bad strategy for some companies.
What do you do as a startup, Matt? And I'll use Microsoft as an example here. They are about to get ready to announce an endpoint detection response product, ATP. When there is this unique situation where the 800-pound gorilla in this case, or maybe 1,600-pound gorilla in Microsoft's case, they like have this unique advantage where they can do it better than anyone else because only they have access to the data. How do you compete with a big player like that, Cisco, IBM, HP, Microsoft, Apple, that is going to start dipping into your space?
Yeah, well, I've always expected that the endpoints will eventually, or, you know, the operating system vendors will do it better themselves, right? Ultimately, Apple and Microsoft are in a better position to protect the endpoint than anybody else. Here's the potential play for another company, though, is if you're 100% focused on Windows and Windows enters the market, I got a problem, right? Because they are going to take share. So then you have to figure out your value outside of just supporting Windows. Does that mean you support other systems, bring all that data together, and then provide higher level analytics and reporting across your entire endpoint ecosystem? That's a potential play, right? If you can't do that, then Microsoft could erode what you're doing, which is probably not a good thing for you. But you've got to figure out that value at a higher level at the end of the day. If Microsoft enters the space, provides the base detection response, then can you provide better analytics across the broader ecosystem? Can you provide better actionability, reporting, whatever, than Microsoft can? Because if you can't, then you're going to have a really hard time competing.
Right. Yeah. And that's typically when I see a larger company try and invade a space like that. While the intricacies of the technology might be better, the other polish is kind of missing, right? And people report back and they're like, yeah, like Microsoft has a thing for that, but it's not as good as some of these other more innovative companies because of X, Y, and Z. Usually that's usability and manageability. As we've seen with Microsoft Active Directory in general, there's tons of tools that tack onto that because Microsoft doesn't do a great job of letting you manage that easily, certainly. Also, in the Microsoft front, my next question is, Microsoft, you talked about security automation orchestration briefly. Microsoft just purchased Hexadite for $100 million. How does that impact the security market potentially moving forward?
Yeah, it was I think it was a great acquisition. Remember, Invitas got bought by FireEye last year and a half ago. So you could see that FireEye was going to go down this automation kind of orchestration path. I guess the question is, what's Microsoft going to do with the Hexadyte acquisition? Is it more for Azure, or is it more for other aspects of security? Remember, they do have a cybersecurity practice and kind of some services wrapped around that. Are they going to leverage it there? Are they going to
Matt froze again. The bandwidth gods are not on our side today. Michael, you there?
No, I left too. If Matt's going to freeze up, I gotta punch out.
Don't leave me, Michael.
I got you.
Michael, what was your thoughts on the Hexadyte acquisition?
We talked about it a little bit last week. And it was wanting to keep looking at it a little bit deeper. But see, I looked at it. It's interesting because I actually more looked at it from the perspective of, look at that. You can develop something. You can get a multiple on it. You can have a successful exit. Now you're part of a bigger ecosystem. And as I'm listening to you and Matt, and you're using Microsoft as an example for things, you know, I think you've pointed out something that's really important to underscore. Even when and Matt basically echoed this, but when you bring something in, like when Microsoft introduces it, Microsoft is looking at its gigantic global install base. It's not going to build for the niche. It's going to build for the, how do we level everybody up and offer them a new feature that they're excited about, which gives you that opportunity to do stuff.
I'm back.
Okay. Good. Yay. Sorry, continue, Michael.
Well, so what I looked at when I looked at the acquisition, I was looking at it as more proof that you don't have to IPO to exit. Like your successful exit can be an acquisition, and we've seen more and more companies like Microsoft setting up venture funds and looking for technologies that they can integrate that let them go after these new things. So the other thing I always look at is, you know, like in terms of Hexadyte or anything else. And Matt already said this. I mean, the endpoint space is going to change. Anybody who calls themselves next generation, I mean, they've shot themselves in the foot because all the big guys will incorporate that within 18 months or less. And so it's those things to me. I'm always more fascinated on the business side of it in terms of what it actually means for Microsoft's play.
Yeah, I mean, I could almost see them combining advanced threat analytics, ATA, with the advanced threat protection they're announcing with some security automation and orchestration. And really kind of making a dent into the security startup space, unless I'm way off base there.
Well, but when you say dent, though, what do you mean by dent? And obviously, Matt's back. I'm curious his take on it, because I actually think, if anything, it fuels the security startup space. I don't think it dampens it.
That's a good point.
No, I think you're right. I see this with Microsoft. I can see this with Google a little bit as well at some point. Is where I think the interesting part of the Hexadyte acquisition is in Azure. Potentially, and looking at bringing more security capabilities into the cloud platforms natively. You know, I've been a big believer that as stuff moves to the cloud and infrastructure is moved to the cloud, security is going to get built into the infrastructure. And is Hexadyte part of that strategy to build more security orchestration automation capabilities into the Azure platform to get more adoption into getting customers to move to Azure? I could see Google doing something very similar. As we all know, AWS builds their own. They don't really acquire. And they've built a lot of security features into their cloud platforms. That's the really interesting part for me, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, it almost, you know, part of me wants to say that the landscape is so big and the offering is so wide from Google and Microsoft in this example that there'll be room for companies to go in and add value in addition to what's already included in the platform.
Yeah, and it's going to reveal new...
Absolutely.
I was going to say, it's going to reveal new problems.
Yeah.
Yeah, and if Microsoft continues to acquire technology in the security space, it does create an interesting, you know, exit for some of these companies that are looking for homes that they may not be able to come out IPO. I mean, Michael, you brought up a good point, right? The exit strategy doesn't have to be IPO anymore. Look at where the markets are and how many IPOs have we had, right? It's still low. We've had what? Okta went, MuleSoft went, Snap went. Okay. But where's the floodgates opening? This market's going like gangbusters, and you don't see the people exiting that you thought would exit, like Titanium or
yeah,
you know,
just
some of these guys.
Their IPO, right? I mean, they just took a big round.
Right.
equity round, which is just a big delay. You know, and it's funny, you look at it, right? Q1's all propped up by Snap, but go look at their overall performance. But then go look at, so Honeywell just opened up a fund, Symantec just opened up a fund, Microsoft launched Microsoft Ventures. Private equity space is dumping cash like it's on fire into the space. How many security funds got started in the last year? Those exits, the buy side on Fortune 500 is heating up, and I think there's a lot of confusion in that space. And so, you know, that's like, I keep looking at all in totality and I go, this is a great time to be a security startup. But I think, Matt, you pinned on it. You've got to know the problem you solve. You got to know the value. Now, Paul and I have had this chat with a lot of people, especially when we go to shows, and I'm fond, right? My favorite question is, what problem are you trying to solve? My second favorite is, and what value does that create? I've had a lot of people tell me to my face, oh, this is security, Michael. We don't have to create value. Obviously, I don't agree with that. But when you go in and you talk to people, how often are you finding, Matt, in your experience, that they're really struggling with the value? And then the sub question is, how much is it that they're really struggling with it versus they haven't put the time in to think it through to articulate the value?
Well, so the first part of the question, I think everybody's struggling with figuring out the value. I'm a big believer there has to be value, and you have to have what I call a power position in the market, right? People, when they see it, they're like, oh, yeah, that's right. And so it's definitely very hard for people to articulate it. There's no doubt about it. Go to any technology, security technology website, try to figure out their why. It's so hard.
Oh, yeah.
I'm serious. I've been doing this for the past 6 weeks. You know, I get a CEO call me on the phone. He says, do me a favor, go to my website, tell me what you think. I'm like, I don't know what you do. I don't understand. I don't get it. Right? It's because we use fear and uncertainty and doubt. That's not value. You need value. The buyers still buy value. If you're not solving a problem they have, they're not buying. Okay? So that's the first part. The second part is, you know, I think it's hard because they've never gone through the exercise of trying to really break down their vision, their point of view, really articulate the problem in a way that they know how they solve it uniquely in the space. And when you can do that, your value starts to come out. Your differentiators start to come out. This message around why I do it different or better is easier to articulate. And if you can do that effectively in a very simplified way, people will start to come, I believe. And I think that's where a lot of people are struggling right now, is they've got really cool technology, but they don't understand the problem it's solving or the value it provides to their buyers. Heck, some of them don't even know their buyers, to be quite honest. They don't know if they're selling to the CISO or the two levels below the CISO.
You know the answer. I get on that a lot.
And everybody's.
I get this. Ready? Michael, there's too many. I can sell to anybody. And it's the same thing with value, right? If there's no value, there's no priority. If you can sell to everybody, then you're selling to nobody. But you're right.
Then if you're selling to everybody, then you have N conversation discussion, right? And now you have to teach your sales force how to have N different conversations depending on who you're talking to. So message goes even one step further, and that is the whole sales enablement, the whole sales process. How do you talk about the company based on who the buyer is? This has such a huge downstream effect. Listen, we can build the best technology in the world, but if we don't have sales, we're dead. It's all about revenue at the end of the day. That's how you're going to get funded. That's how you're going to go IPO. You need revenue, which means if your sales guys can't articulate the message to who they're selling to, those people aren't buying.
Well, and then there's a second phase to that, which, Matt, you probably single-handedly taught me, is that how you package your products. Okay, so now you've convinced them, yes, you should buy this. If you get to that purchasing stage, one of the things that Matt and I worked on together was, well, how do you package all the services? Like, how do they buy it? What do they buy? Is it subscription? How much is the subscription? How deeply do you let them break it down? And those are equally as important, because the sales process can completely fall down on its face if the customer is confused as to what they're buying and how they're buying.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, packaging and pricing is another important piece. I mean, you know, now everybody's selling subscription these days. Mm. That's how people are used to buying. The question is it annual subscription? Is it monthly? You know, we're moving to a consumption-based model more and more with the cloud. You know, we can sell annualized prepaid subscriptions till we're blue in the face, but eventually customers are going to say, you know what, I just want to buy this for 3 months. Mm-hmm. right. or I just want to pay month to month. And so you have to be, again, if you understand your buyer, then you know how they're willing to pay for it.
Right.
Then you build the right packaging and pricing around it to make it easier for them to buy. You take friction out of the sales motion at that point.
Right, right.
That's also got
you're echoing some of Michael's words, which is great.
Yeah, no, I've thoroughly loved, like, you're the real life example of a lot of the things that that get me excited. But it also sounds too like pricing and packaging is going to come down to value, right? So if people want to keep driving you to smaller pieces, your price has always got to be able to allow them to obtain higher value than they could get any other way. And then still, right, and then create value for you offering it in that way. And so when people say, well, I mean, it's security, I can't do value, I'm always like, then how the hell are you pricing it? Like, how are you getting a return? And it sounds like unit economics are probably still a challenge for a lot of folks when you take a look at it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, your pricing models have to focus on outcome. Can they measure the outcome and the value right. provided versus another cost? Compliance is a perfect example of this, right? Remember the early days of PCI, everybody thought this was like, oh my gosh, it's gold rush, right? Everybody's going to buy my service because, you know, they need me for PCI. But when the mitigating controls cost more than the fines,
yeah.
people aren't going to pay.
Fine's a good choice at that point.
Right, exactly. At that point, I'll just pay the fine. Why would I spend $1 million if the fine's, you know, 50K or whatever the number is, right? So if you don't understand that about the market and the buyer that you're selling into, then you can price yourself out of the market where people are like, I don't need to buy you.
Right. We're running short on time. I did want to just quickly get your take, Matt, on One Login. They are in the SSO space. And they're a Series C funded company. Their latest round was in 2014 for $25 million. They recently had one of the most devastating breaches, I think, I've seen in quite some time. I mean, essentially, your customers have to like redo everything to change all of their passwords, keys, trust relationships within your product, which erodes trust. From a startup, I guess, multi-part question, right? Like, what do you do to avoid that stuff? And then what do you do if, God forbid, it does happen?
Yeah, I mean, this one's a pretty tough one, right? Your startup, you get a major hack, and the fix is not easy, right?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, security in your own products as a security company matters, right? So we can't forget that we're in the space of security, and therefore our product should be secure. So don't forget about that. You know, having a security officer is probably a pretty good idea, even in a product company, just to make sure you got your stuff mapped out. You know, now it's damage control. The question is, can they continue to help their customers easily get through this? Can they rebuild their reputation and their brand? If they can't, it's probably the end, unfortunately. But right. yeah, I mean, this is one of the downsides of major breaches and brand damage. I don't know where this is going to end up, but right now it doesn't look that good.
Yeah, I agree. Well, Matt, thank you very much for appearing on Startup Security Weekly. It was wonderful having you. Good catching up with you in general as well.
Thank you. It was always fun. I have hit the trifecta now, so
that's,
you know,
right.
We gotta,
that's right.
We got to go through it again or something.
Exactly. There's other shows we can bring you on as well. We'll get you rounded through all of our shows. So okay, with that, we're going to take a short break, come back, and talk about startup news. Stay tuned. IT Pro TV, an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. Access over 2,000 hours of up-to-date, high-quality video content live and on demand for a free 7-day trial and 30% off the lifetime of your account. Visit itpro.tv/startup security and use the code SS30. Gain control of cyber risk with Tenable.io, the first vulnerability management platform built for today's elastic assets like cloud, containers, and web apps. Discover a fresh, asset-based approach that prioritizes vulnerabilities while seamlessly integrating into your environment. And improve ROI with the first elastic licensing approach based on assets, not IP addresses. Tenable.io delivers the data and context you need to secure your elastic attack surface. Start your free Tenable.io trial today by visiting Tenable.io.
Welcome back, everyone.
on to Startup Security Weekly. A couple of quick announcements. IT Pro TV's courses now include Computer Hacking Forensic Investigator V9, Kali Linux, CompTIA A+ 901, and Accelerated CompTIA Security Plus. Premium annual memberships include all video content as well as access to virtual labs and Q&A forums. Normally, you'd pay $85.70 a month or $857 per year, but we've got a special offer for our listeners for a limited time. Get 30% off monthly memberships for the lifetime of your active subscription using the code SS30. Also, Wild West Hackenfest is coming to you by Red Team Specialists from Black Hills Information Security. Join us on October 27th and 28th, where there will be talks by Dave Kennedy, Deviant Egypt, Chris Nickerson, Chris Gates, Mike Poor, Sub-T, and more. All hands-on workshops will be available to all attendees. WildWestHackinFest.com, HackinFest.com. AnyCon is happening. It's not just AnyCon. It is, well, AnyCon. Albany, New York on June 16th and 17th. There will be a Capture the Flag, Hardware Hacking Village, and a ping pong tournament. Dave Kennedy will be delivering the keynote. Security Weekly will be there. Doug White will be there doing Hacker Movie Trivia, handing out Security Weekly t-shirts, stickers, glassware, and a select amount of our brand new Security Weekly challenge coins. And finally, the first B-Sides in Uganda, B-Sides Kampala, is going to be held October 14th and 15th. The CFP is open now until July 15th. They're looking for talks on network security, web application security, innovative attack and defense strategies, malware analysis, biometrics, evolutionary computing, robotics, and bonus points if you bring an actual robot. Visit B-SidesKampala.com to submit your talk today. Sorry, I forgot to read the announcements in the first segment, so there was a lot of them, but we got through them, and now we're ready to talk about some startup news. Michael,
it's one of the parts of the show I always enjoy, and sometimes I like to get your take on things. Let's start with this one. Should you listen to the business gurus? I mean, obviously I think people should listen to us, but I've never held myself out as a guru. I don't think you have either, so you should listen to us. But there's an article I grabbed, and I just thought it was good, and it was kind of pointing out how a lot of the advice out there, if you're not careful, it'll conform to whatever bias you have. So you should totally listen to customers. Nope, don't listen to customers at all. You should totally focus on one thing. Nope, you should do a lot of different stuff. Nope, you should. And so, you know, what I've kind of found is I've always taken what I call the Bruce Lee approach, which was borrow from the things that work and test them. And learn from them. And if it works, keep doing it. If it doesn't work, don't do it.
I kind of just had this notion of, it's kind of like the way I tend to approach it is, it's kind of like threat modeling for applications or for network security. I go through like this business modeling, right? Where you take different approaches and advice and you kind of run through the model in your head, like, well, like, what would that do? What impacts would that have? How would it help? How might it hurt? And you just kind of model it out, and you know, don't you take everyone's advice at face value and go, oh, well, that's what I need to do. My advice is to model it out. And, you know, I think that's pretty common sense kind of stuff. I don't think it's anything really new and innovative, but, you know, I like to model some things out. And as we've said in the past, don't be afraid to, you know what, after you model them out, don't think about it too much. Go do something. Doing nothing's certainly not going to help you.
Yeah. And I think what you pointed out is there's a fine line. There's the, you know, what I always like to do, I maybe do modeling by a different name. I got to think that through, but I always try to understand, okay, why did they do this and why does it work? So for me, it's always about context. Mm-hmm. So if you've been in the industry for 30 years, you've got a ton of money and a bunch of people that already know your previous track record, well, then whatever worked for you is not going to work for somebody who's getting started at 20.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like I always look at that context and say, okay, but why did they do that? And does that still work, or was that a one-time trick? And then I look for some trends and patterns on that. But what I've learned in the last year or two is the second part, which you just said, don't get too hung up on it. Then try it, but small bets, simple stuff. Try it, see if it works, move it forward, and then move on to the next thing. I've noticed that sometimes people will reach out and they kind of want my opinion on, do you like A or do you like B, or who do you listen to? And, you know, I listen to a lot of people, and I meld it together. And I think there's a lot of really smart people out there that frankly sometimes say some pretty stupid stuff, but then there's some really silly people that say some really brilliant stuff. And I think the trick to me is just observe it as it is, and then figure out what it fits. But then it's a why. Like, I always want to know then, why did it work? Why does it fit? Because I think if you can't answer that, well, I don't know. Maybe I'm slowing myself down by being able to do that. I'll tell you what, though, if you want to stand out. So this, I'm always fascinated by people who do stuff like this. So Tech Investor, this is a headline. Tech Investor analyzed his 5,000 monthly emails and explained how startups can stand out. Now, what's interesting is when he broke down his emails, he was pretty fair. And he said, look, most of these are newsletters and updates and things that I don't really need to worry about too much. But what he started to notice was when he replies. So he said, like, look, I reply on the train ride home. I seem to do more on Wednesday than other days. The top recipients were the people who were already in his network. And so that's the key to this is, you know, this guy said, look, I have above average email volume. Mm-hmm. But he really broke it down. And he said, you know, if you want to cut through the noise, don't cold pitch me. Go find whoever my close advisors are. Convince one of them. And then they'll make an introduction, because if it's coming from them, I'm already going to see it. I'm already attuned to their names, to their stuff coming across it. And think about that with you and me, you know, or anybody else. If I see somebody, you know, if you say, hey, Michael, would you talk to so-and-so? I'm in, and yep. Vice versa. And
we just did that with Matt in between the segments, yeah. Actually. Yeah.
And so that's how a lot of these types of things start to work as we're taking a look at it. And but I thought it was interesting because it wasn't the age old, well, you know, a friend should introduce me. It was much more of a, I went and looked at the data. Let me tell you, if you're just pitching me, there's too much noise. I'm not going to pay attention to it. And thanks. So I thought it was interesting. He did say, though, if you come in cold, then, you know, don't BS me. And I'll tell you, I tell you what, I got a email pitch today. I was impressed. I'm going to take it. And once it goes public, I'll mention it. But they basically said, I started the new series, The Security Slapshots. They said, hey, we've read them. My CEO wants to do it. In fact, I'll tell you what, one of the pitches I got was, our CEO of the company is a former NHL hockey player. He'd love to do a slapshot. You had my attention. I'm like, yeah, let's do it. You're right. And the one today, they actually said, here, we read it, we like it, and here's our thoughts. Are you interested? Yep. Boom. Solid. Like it caught my attention. It didn't take a lot of time, right on point. And it was interesting. So it made it really easy to go forward and knock it out. So I thought,
yeah, cool. I think, you know, when I look at my inbox, I've gotten to the point where I can really tell who's done their homework and who hasn't. And I tell if you haven't done your homework, it's instantly deleted. And I can tell pretty much instantly just based on what you're pitching. For example, I probably get a couple of emails a day about people saying, well, your blog articles are really fascinating. And I'm like, yeah. We don't really post. We're a podcast company. Or they're pitching me on something that's like completely not security related. And I'm like, dude, you've done no homework. Like, there's an about page that tells what we do. You didn't even go read that. You're just blind pitching a bunch of podcasts and whatever. And that's the ones I will respond to are the ones that actually did at least read the about page and understand even a fraction of what we do. Those one people I will and have engaged with, even if it's a small percentage, but you know, if it's a cold email, sometimes I will, based on that criteria, respond. So I guess, you know what, people can get value from that. That's awesome.
I've done the same thing. I can tell pretty quick. I get a lot of pitches, and I'm down to, I take three actual pitch conversations a week. That's kind of my limit. Sometimes I'll do a couple more, but that means I'm accepting about 120 or so pitches a year right now. Yeah. And what I've learned with it then is that, I mean, no surprise to anybody, I'm a straight talker, but if you're close to something or it looks kind of interesting, like if it's all just bland marketing speak and I didn't understand any of it anyway, what I've learned over the last 2 or 3 years of doing this is if I reply, then you just hit me with more and you suck up more of my time. Ugh. And I just want to bang my head into a desk. But what I've started doing is if you're pretty close and I could tell you didn't just cut and paste this in, I might write back with, I'm sorry, I don't see the angle here, or help me understand. And then one of two things happens. They don't respond back, or they come back and they say, right, okay, well, here it is. And they level it up. And I find those are always kind of interesting. And I'll give you an example. I had somebody, I don't remember even who it was. They sent me something, some survey they had just done, and they said, so this proves you know, that executives are stupid or something like that. And I wrote back, well, I'm reading the same data, and what it actually suggests to me is that executives care, but that the security team hasn't convinced them, hasn't provided them a solution that allows them to get the job done and is standing in the way. I said, so, you know, I'm happy to have the conversation, but that's didn't even bother to respond.
You know how, too bad. So if you didn't know me at all, Michael, and I sent you an email and I started it with, Michael, I'm a big fan of your blog on CSO. I liked your article on XYZ because of ABC reasons. If I started my email with that, I probably have a much higher percentage that you would respond to whatever follows that, right? If it made sense.
Yeah, if it made sense. You know, what I do see, like, so for example, I just did, I've got one more in the series on cyber insurance, and it's completely changed a lot of my thinking on cyber insurance. So now I get a lot of, oh, well, you should talk to me about cyber insurance. Guys, I just ran six articles on cyber insurance.
Right.
Wrong time to hit me with that.
Yeah.
But, you know, on the Slapshot side, saying, hey, I like what you did with that, you know, can we participate in that? That's a good story. And so, and in fact, that's what happened this morning. I've seen your Slapshot. Here's a link. Here's what we liked. Here's the person. Like, they didn't waste my time. Like, it was, yeah, those tend to get my attention. Yeah. No, you're right. That definitely works. Let's talk about startups versus businesses. This is a theme you and I have built on. And so I'm kind of curious your take on this. And I feel like it's a little bit about putting some semantics out there. And yet I didn't have a problem with it. And the notion is, go build a business. Don't try to be a startup. Now, before I forget, I got some feedback this week from some of our listeners that, Paul, our advice is helping them, that we've got people that are looking at, you know, starting smaller than their ideas right now with what can they do nights and weekends? How can they do some consulting on the side? How can they test it out? And it's great. And I've responded to everybody. So if you're in that situation, hit us up. Tell us what it's like. Because you know, one of the people I responded to, I made it really clear, you're not alone. Like, it may feel that way at times, especially when you're trying to wrap your head around this stuff. You can reach out to us, and I, you know, we'll respond. You know, short, tight, but we'll respond with it. But this, to me, kind of connects to it. The idea here is you don't have to be big. You don't have to be the next unicorn. You start small. If it starts with consulting, start with consulting. And all I would say there is just stay in your lane. And I don't mean that as a derogatory thing, like a do all you can do. What I mean is don't get distracted. Do something. Right? And what have we said before? Get somebody to pay you your first $1,000. Then earn $1,000 a month. Then start to figure out how to level that up. Now, I think a lot of people would struggle to live on $1,000 a month. But if you're just starting something on the side, right, you got to get paid. And then you got to get paid a little bit more. And you got to get paid by more than one person. And if you can start figuring those pieces out, then it kind of comes together. And what I thought this made sense with here, and I'm going to have to just kind of paraphrase this, but what they looked at was, a lot of people look at this concept and they say, okay, I've got a great business idea. Now I just need an investor. And then once I have an investor, oh, we're off to the races. It's all going to work. And it doesn't work that way. Investors come with a certain set of pressures and expectations. But by the way, you don't get an investor because you had a great idea. By the way, I know there's examples where that does happen. But typically, you've got to go show somebody that you've got actual product market fit, that you're solving a problem in a way that creates value, that levels up the organization. If you're not doing that, then why would I invest in you? Because you seem like a nice person. And so what this basically said is just take your time. Go build a business. Build something sustainable that actually turns a profit. It's not about, let me flip this. Let me go. I'm going to go buy it. 5 years, I'm going to sell it. And then I'm going to go retire and have a big yacht. Instead, go find something really cool. Solve it. And be really good at it. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think bootstrapping definitely breeds that build a business culture more so than the startup. And I think that's, you can't lose sight of that.
Yeah, I mean, to be clear, there's a time for money. There's a time where your timeliness to penetrate the market absolutely requires a big infusion of cash and the guidance from somebody who's been there, done that, and you want them to have a vested interest in it. That makes a lot of sense. There's also certain types of problems that you're trying to solve that are really expensive. So you need a prototype, or you need something manufactured, in which case then, yes, an infusion of cash and a way to make it work also makes sense. But this whole, I got an idea, once I get investors, we're off and running, I think bootstrapping it, you're going to learn a lot more. And as you and I have talked about a lot on the program, you need to learn sales. You need to learn marketing. You need to learn some of these concepts. And I don't know of a better teacher than going through it. Mm-hmm. Yes, using structured accountability and working through some of these accelerators, if you can get accepted and stuff, they're great. But you can get a lot of that, but you got to go do it. There's talking right. about it and there's doing it. Get off the couch, try it out. Try it out nights and weekends. Keep it simple. And there are a ton of stories of people who did something night and weekends and it took off enough where they quit their job, changed their lifestyle, and lived happily ever after. And that could be you if you're listening. So that's fantastic stuff. What do you think of Google's 20% time?
So, yeah. Well, no, I was just going to start talking about this because I think it's intriguing. I think Google's 20% time works for Google because Google can just add more employees to complete all of their projects on time, and they're a big enough company to do that. When you're a startup, can't necessarily, well, you can't. I don't think you can adopt the same model as a company the size of Google. And I think it's just pretty much common sense. I do like where the article talks about, because this is how I would approach it, coming up with a model that fits your business, essentially, is what the article is talking about, just skimming it, right? And so if I were to do a similar thing here with my own startup, I would maybe schedule some time and schedule a day. It's kind of a page out of like Logarithm's book. Logarithm does this as they've talked about on the show, right? They've got, hey, everyone stop what they're doing, spend a couple of days. We can plan for that, right? And come up with some innovative stuff. And you know what? That works and it fits into their product. Or you take a day that you plan out into the future and you say, we're going to go as a team learn about this new technology, this other technology. Someone's going to, you know, give some training classes internally and learn from each other. I think if it's scheduled out for smaller companies, it is highly effective.
That's yeah, I like it. And the only thing I would say that I like about it in smaller companies is use that time to figure out how people can stay connected to the vision. What I start to see now with some of the smaller companies that I work with, the startups, is people like, look, you got to pay the bills. So you take on this project or you get entrenched in this effort and it's a good effort and you really like it. But what I like about the notion of a 20% time or some sort of a dedicated time on whatever percentage and schedule works for you is what you're saying is I want you to stay connected to whatever passion you have for our vision, right? I like to use value prop as a guiding star. Do you feel like you're contributing to that? And by the way, are you taking everything else that you're learning and are you contributing that in? And so to that extent, I love this as a concept, but kind of like our Ed Follow the Business Guru's advice. You're right. Look, when you're an organization like Google or some of the others that have done it, they've got the capitalization to do stuff like this.
Yeah, exactly.
But what I would say too is that I think there's another part to this. Now, again, giving up a day a week, right? That's 20%. That's a full day a week. Wow. Okay, that feels like a lot. But what I also think is interesting is the more disciplined and focused you are as an organization, which goes back to value prop as a guiding star, then the easier that is. Like you can take that time. And all I can say in my own experience is over the last couple months, I've consciously stopped working on weekends. I consciously step away during lunch and don't bring electronics with me. And now my wife and I go out we're up to like a 5.5, almost 6 mile walk every night. And then sometimes I'll go sit out front, no technology, just sit. Frankly, I'm just watching cars drive by. But what I found is some of that purposeful unstructured time or some of that purposeful time away has made me much more focused when I'm at work. Right. And I'm getting more stuff done. I've had a couple people compliment me that, you know, I've grown more as a business in the last 30 days than the previous 6 months. Some of that might just be, you know, the intense focus I have on it. But gosh, some of that might be some of those changes. So I think there's merit in saying take some structured time away related to the business, then come back and see what fits. I like it. 20%? Yeah, all right. Well, maybe. I mean, depends on the business you run, I guess. All right. Always looking for things that I think are interesting. 90% of VC investment in follow-on rounds, only a few focus on the first deals. So this starts out, and of course, you know, they're going to have my interest as soon as they mention friction. So it's, mm-hmm. it's tough to sort out.
A lot of friction going on.
Back from friction, yeah. But one thing's clear. Have you noticed, Paul, there's like two narratives, right? Oh, there's no money any place. Well, there's too much money every place. Oh, these deals are getting so large. Oh, these seed rounds are so small.
it's all over the map, dude. I, I don't know. I think a lot of it's just clickbait. I think, can we just lump that in with just clickbait? And it depends on, to steal a page out of your book, Michael, it depends on your lens and how you're looking at things. So,
yeah, I just, you know, and that's why I kind of keep pushing this out, because you stand it. So what I've started to look at, and this matches up to stuff that we've talked about, but what they basically said, look, don't view fundraising as your end goal. So that's a theme we've been building on. But this is the one I really kind of like. Sales and customers cure all. Right? And this is how I look at it more and more. And I think I've had a couple people point out to me that we actually see, like, there's West Coast investing versus East Coast investing. And now we're starting to see pockets, right? I mean, Boston's popping up big. Austin's big. Silicon Valley's still big. We're seeing a lot of stuff now, right? Denver, the Maryland area, right? So when we're looking at a lot of the stuff that you and I are tracking, there's probably 8 cities in the U.S. that are driving a lot of these different things, and they all have regional flavors to it. But what I'm starting to notice is this. Do you have a problem that people are aware of that they want to solve, and are they willing to pay you money to solve it? If the answer to that question is yes, and it's yes more than once, then you are less of a risk to an early round investor. And we've brought some of these seed stage, early stage investors on our program, and they're looking for an idea. They're looking for a concept. They're looking for something in an area that they know well that they think can solve a problem. And if you can bring that to them and say, oh, P.S., I've got these 10 companies, or these 5 companies that have paid for it, and here's our customers, and here's what it's looking like, and here's how it's working. I mean, let's obligatory bring up Shark Tank. How many times do they say, do you have a P.O.? You know, do you have orders with the company? Yes. And have they reordered? Yes. Okay, so what's your problem? I don't have the capitalization to fill the reorder. Great. Different problem than, well, I mean, you know, we've talked about it. They said they liked it. They gave us a thumbs up and a smiley face. You know, it's, and so I like this again, because the way I, you know, we've talked with people about, do you do debt deals? Do you not do debt deals? Do you bootstrap? How do you look, focus on it? And this didn't say profitability, but what this basically said was, will somebody part with their cash? Right, because the problem you're solving is a high enough priority for them, and the solution you're offering them is compelling enough that you're going to create the value that they need, that they're willing to do it. And like I said, you know, to me, 3 is the start of a trend. 5 in a row, 5, you're getting the data that you need. Right. And as an investor, that takes the risk away.
So Honeywell has launched a venture fund, Michael.
Yeah, not surprising. But I like calling these out because, like I said, right? So we see more and more companies are doing this in more and more ways. Honeywell did it, $100 million venture fund. That is not a small fund. And right. And so it lists the names here. So Caterpillar's done it. Scotch Tape has done it. Well, so it's 3M, but I thought it was funnier that way. Boeing has done it as well. Honeywell, a lot of people don't know this. Honeywell is a huge, huge billion-dollar organization. And among other things, they're big in aerospace. And so one of the things that's interesting is they're specifically calling out, we're going to look at technology in an aerospace. So I look at that and go, you know, there's security implications there. 100%. Anytime you're looking at technology and Internet of Things and sensors and information, then you know security is at play there. If you're at home, so some of the reasons I bring these up is because they're going to be looking for solutions to these types of problems. You might have insights there. It might be something small that is far bigger than you think. So I thought that was interesting. Now, these next two articles, you kind of need to take together. We can break them down separately. The first one, so Crunchbase comes out and it says, startup investments picking up in Q1. Like we're off to the races and things are going to do really good. And remember, you and I addressed the decline in Q4 with like a, look, it's end of the, like, stop everybody. Yeah. Like you're freaking out over it. And they said, yeah, our bad. We freaked out over it. But look, money's back, money's flowing, everything's good. Next article, these both ran in the same week, like a day or two apart, said cybersecurity startups, they're going to be funded at a slower pace. They're going to have lower valuations. Now, this one in particular, I kind of wanted your opinion on it. It starts out by saying that there were two challenges. So what it basically does is it says, okay, a lot of this started back in 2012 and there's all these security problems and that causes all this attention. And then FireEye got a ton of money and then Edward Snowden happened. And so all of a sudden security matters. And it said, so here's two challenges. Many companies weren't even doing the basics right. And number two, the previous generation of security products were just plain inadequate. I think they missed on both of those. Telling me people aren't doing the basics right. I was on a call again today, and at some point I'm going to be pushed to actually try this out. But I've often said I could run a series of top 10 basics for 10 weeks in a row and not have to repeat once. I'm willing to bet I could do it for 5 weeks, but I'm actually thinking it's probably closer to 10. So this whole basics, right? It's fundamentals. We got to get off that because it's loaded with too much crap. But then telling me that the previous generation of products were inadequate, like, that doesn't feel right to me. Does that feel right to you? Like,
no.
Those were the problems we're trying to solve?
Yeah, I agree with the security basics thing being a bunch of bunk.
All right, so then handful of investment themes. Back to the better basics. I'll say I actually don't mind that as a theme. You just got to define for me what the basic is and how it works. Analyze and automate. We're watching that coming. But then solve the people problem. Look, if you've been following me for any period of time, the simplest way to piss me off fast is call it a people problem. Now, I'll be up front. I wrote about this in Into the Breach, and I actually, and it's funny because I remember the discussion with my editor. It's left in there as a people problem. The only regret I have in Into the Breach is I left that. I go on to explain, though, in almost the same paragraph, we don't have a people problem. What we have is a paradox where we've disconnected people from the consequences of their actions. So they can't take responsibility when they want to. We don't let them take ownership, and we can't hold them accountable. That's the problem. It's that people are disconnected. So we don't have a people problem, and nothing drives me crazier than saying we've got a people problem because frankly, we don't. However, if you wanted to say we could do a better job of creating user experience, all right, I'm in. I buy that 100%. And then it talks about DevSecOps. So here's my point, though. Like, when, you know, I've been doing this for 21 years now. I don't see this as being representative of our space. I don't see this as being representative of the problems that we're tackling. I think this totally misses it. And so with that, it then coming back and saying, okay, so here's the deal. And I highlighted two pieces. It said revenue, cash burn, valuation is just too far out of line. In 2016, we started to see the formerly high-flying startups get, you know, course corrected and call some names out. But and then it says, and in 2017, we're going to see more companies running into trouble. Yeah. By the way, that's how this works. So, like, I don't see that as a sign then that we're going to have funded at a slower pace or lower valuations. I think it goes back to what Matt just said. How well do you articulate the value of the problem that you're trying to solve in the marketplace? And what I add to it is impact. What's your solution impact? If you can articulate that right, you'll be good. Look, you and I shudder. Well, I'll speak for you. I shudder every time somebody crowns another unicorn. I don't see it. I don't get it. But does that mean then that we're going to see lower valuations and slower investment? I need to go add it up. There's over $1 billion of security funds raised that closed in the last quarter or two. $1 billion. So you're telling me we're going to have let? No, there's more. There's more competition. Private equity is streaming into the space to free up that venture capital. So then there's going to be more investments. People are hunting. Now, is there confusion in the marketplace? Yes. Is there complexity in the marketplace? Yes. If you're a startup, you've got to get past that. But like telling me that it's going to be slower and everything else, all I wanted to point out is I pretty much disagree with the bulk of the analysis, except for those two lines that I completely agree with that I think are part of the functional process. And P.S., if you're a security company and you're going to, you know, not heed our advice and you really think your solution is you got to get funded, there's plenty of cash out there for you. You just got to go articulate your problem really well with a really good value proposition.
Absolutely. There's too many That's problems to solve. Yep.
Yeah. Risk Recon. So Risk Recon, $12 million Series A. By the way, their seed round was a $3 million seed round. That's huge. So I don't know a lot about them. Software as a service, right? Vendor risk management. This is a space we're going to see growing. If you look at the changes that came down in the last couple of years to HIPAA and other things, you look at the focus now on third-party risk management, you look at, frankly, and I don't mean to insult anybody, but the overall immaturity of our field to handle it, looking to somebody else that can help you assess firms, I think that's on the rise. I think it's going to be a little hectic for a while because we're going to start by doing things that are sound good and we're going to codify it and work to where it starts to make more sense. But I thought that was kind of interesting. You have any insights? Have you come across Risk Recon?
I have not. I'm familiar with the vendor risk management problem a little bit. I think it's primarily targeting the enterprise. Right. I think you know, mid-market definitely doesn't have this problem. So I'm not sure how much competition there is in the space, but
there's a ton. I mean, I would miss a bunch of names, but I mean, if you think about, right, so we've talked about CyberGRX, they're creating a spot on this. And there's, Risk Ratings, right? We've had James Gellert, Rapid Ratings rather. We've had Gellert on the program, and there's been three or four other people that have looked at and done that exact same thing. So I think it's a growing area. And what we find is a lot of people are really struggling how to do it internally versus externally. What I'm curious is when you sell it as a subscription, how are you validating it on that end? But maybe this is something we'll have to look into a little bit more. CounterTAC, $20 million Series D. So they're up to almost $100 million in funding. And they are real-time endpoint threat detection and response.
EDR.
Yeah. So, you know, what I thought was interesting was Xconomy ran a story basically saying after Trump's cybersecurity executive order that made it easier for them in conjunction with WannaCry and also the type of stuff. And so it made it hot. Again, I'm going to say probably not. I'm going to say probably what worked here is they could show somebody that they had some strong fundamentals. Or, you know, remember, right, the time you have the most strength with the bank is when you owe them a lot. If you've already got $80 million in funding tied up and you're not getting the product market fit you want, you're not getting the traction you want, then, you know, $80 million is a lot of money. And it might be easier for the investors to throw another $20 million at it. And what we probably need to start looking for here is let's see what happens with the board, and let's see what happens with the executive team.
Now, these numbers are estimated, but it says CounterTAC compared to Cylance. It says CounterTAC has 71 employees compared to 720 at Cylance. Total funding for Cylance is $177 million, $97 million for CounterTAC. And their revenue, CounterTAC, is estimated at $8 million and Cylance at $9 million. So that could be a reason why they got a Series D.
Right. And I was just going to point out, it really could be that they're, I have no insight on CounterTAC, but you're exactly right. Like when you start looking at that, you know, and we know Cylance has had, right? Cylance just laid off in the last couple of months, 20% of their workforce and have like a really off quarter. So, you know, and this kind of goes back to my point. I don't want to be the unicorn. Like, I don't think that's a good strategy. CounterTAC might just have some really solid fundamentals. They're executing really well, right? Because keep in mind, so when you get to a Series D, you're either late stage or you're growth stage. And that means that, you know, it's all about fueling it. $20 million for a Series D is not a big round. I mean, we routinely see $50 and $100 million Series CDE. So $20 million is not huge. And it might just be what they need to keep kind of fueling their growth and plodding along in it. You know, but last part, and this is just more of a, if you tend to follow these things, and I think you should, Mary Meeker has, decade or longer now, been pretty much she issues a report every year, and it's the go-to read report. Like, go read what Mary Meeker says about the internet and the trends and what's happening. Fortune ran a piece I thought captured some of the highlights really well, and the reason I decided to throw it in here is because we're in the startup space. And so I look at this for two reasons. Let's go take a look at what we see happening and why we think that that's potentially interesting or important. And then at the same time, let's also take a look at those trends from a security perspective and say, which of these growing trends then suggest we need to think about some of these things from a security perspective. Like, they have a piece to this that's going to matter. So smartphone growth is slowing, but online advertising is growing thanks to mobile. Mm-hmm. So the growth is slowing, but you're going to see more advertising. Voice is on the rise. The bar for quality customer support is rising. To me, that stood out instantly. If you're a startup today and you want to be different, your support has got to be exquisite. You've got to be remarkable in that people say, wow, I love that. And you and I have talked about companies that have thoroughly impressed both of us. But I'm thinking back to your Linux laptop experience with how awesome that was for you. Mm-hmm. By the way, are you still enjoying that?
I am. And in fact, I've gone on to purchase another system from the fine folks at System 76. And I'm very happy with my purchase. Imagine that.
There you go. Talks about the e-commerce is growing. Video gaming is evolving. Still the early days. Streaming media is growing. And then it talks about moving into China, moving into India, and looking at things there. So, and there's a lot more. It's like a 200-slide report. I put the link in the show notes to the report itself. But it's the kind of thing where if you're trying to understand your fit in the marketplace and where the trends are going, read it. you don't have to, it's not the end all be all, but I think it's a really interesting data point, and it gets a lot of people in investment circles thinking and talking. So awesome. At least knowing it is useful to you.
Awesome.
In terms of journeys, like, you know, for a rare change, I don't have a lot to say. I'm just kind of executing and getting stuff done and enjoying it. I did get something. So this week, I was really excited about this. We talk a lot about cyber insurance. So I got Garen Pace from AIG, and we talk about what it's really like. And one of the things I talked about was, okay, but can cyber insurance actually help us level up? And okay, so do you guys pay out or not pay out? And answers to both of those are in that piece.
Nice.
It was a fun conversation. How about you, man? How are things?
Software development lifecycle. I'm about to get, little hands-on with, building a production system to basically push out your software, right? And that's, I think, a really pivotal moment in certainly something that constantly evolves. But being able to have a stable environment to push from dev to QA to production to kind of speak to that customer support, right? You need that foundation to build on. And I think when you're, you know, early stage bootstrap startup, you know, a lot of those processes may not be in place. So it'll be interesting to see where we're at, get an update and make recommendations and, of course, learn some things as well. You know, while I have a long history with software, certainly, as Matt and I were mentioning before the show and on the show with containers and DevOps, it's certainly evolving and changing. And I'm doing my best to keep up, and I'm going to be a little more hands-on with that technology so we can hopefully make some smart decisions and have an awesome process for pushing out software. So
that's awesome.
It's important. Yeah, it's exciting.
I love it.
So that will conclude this edition of Startup Security Weekly. Thank you, everyone, for listening and watching. See everyone next time.